What's happening? I bet you were expecting one of the other Go Loud podcast hosts, but no.
Instead, you get me, Teddy Flower.
And me, COB. And we're interrupting your podcast to tell you all about the great content on Disney Plus this Christmas.
There's the Emmy Award winning The Bear, which follows a struggling restaurant and the staff trying their best to make it better. You think there's carnage in your gaff over a game of 30 seconds? You should see what happens with these fellas just trying to make a sandwich.
Mate, that gives me mad anxiety watching them running around the kitchen, but you can't look away because you need to know what's going to happen next.
There's also one of the year's biggest box office hits, Deadpool and Wolverine with Ryan Reynolds and Hugh Jackman. It's a superhero film and a comedy all in one.
And don't forget the Christmas classics like Home Alone and Die Hard.
Is Die Hard a Christmas film? He's fighting terrorists, isn't it?
Yeah, but at Christmas.
Look, I'm happy with any excuse to watch Bruce Willis battering people. And there's a show that everyone's talking about, Rivals, which is some buzz.
Well, then go ahead and sign up to Disney Plus at $9.99 per month.
Christmas is better with Disney Plus. All the days and more streaming this Christmas.
So at this point, I'm hoping you're full to the brim with turkey, ham, pudding, chocolate, Kimberley, Quality Street, and anything else you could get your chops around over the last few days. And now you might be feeling like a bit of a walk, or a trip to the gym, or else some quiet time alone, have a little stroll, and stick on your favourite podcast, the Mario Rosenstock podcast, hopefully. So as you start to wind down from the Christmas mayhem and indulgence, and I hope you had a lovely Christmas, I thought you might like to hear some absolutely fascinating stories from a master storyteller with a great voice. Playwright Peter Sheridan has crossed America on a road trip with actor Sean Penn, developed a cocaine addiction through his friendship with an LA dealer named Cuban Mike, auditioned top Hollywood actresses like Renee Zellweger, and learned rebel songs directly from Crystal Moore. Crystal Moore? Christy Moore. How did I say that? He's done so much, lived to tell the tales, and he tells them wonderfully on an epic episode of the Mario Rosenstock podcast. Peter joined me in the very early days of this series, so we thought it was time to bring it out of the cellar and unveil it again like a fine wine, a vintage storyteller like Peter Sheridan. And enjoy it all over again. You're going to love this one. But before we join Peter, if you're feeling like moving the body a bit this Christmas and having great crack at the same time, On Ice is the place for you. On Ice is our sponsor. They're bringing back the magic of ice skating this winter season and this festive season. OnIce.ie, that's where you can grab your tickets. They are a fantastic company. It's a family activity. Get out there, enjoy it, find a new hobby, a new activity, feel invigorated. Afterwards, bring your family along and go ice skating. Why not? Go ice skating. Think about it. Isn't it a wonderful thing to do? Well, On Ice are all over the country. Cork, Galway, Limerick, Marina Market in Cork, Dublin in Dundrum and Swords. And they run a great shop, and thanks for getting involved with us on the Mario Rosenstock podcast on ice.ie. So it's time to rejoin Peter Sheridan. Peter and I know each other from working together. I played Kino in the musical iKino, and Peter was our great director on that. We had a wonderful, wonderful discovery of what it was like to unveil that show for the first time. We didn't have a clue. We were all in togas, which were very revealing for people who were sitting in beneath the stage, we learned in the early days. We had to get proper jocks. And going around as Roy Keane in a toga and a skirt, and Mick McCarthy in a skirt and swords, was very funny. And we had some wonderful, wonderful adventures. I remember Paul McGrath coming in to see the show. Roy Keane himself came in to see the show. I remember Brian O'Driscoll coming in to see the show with the entire Irish rugby team. A fantastic experience.
And we started our chat there with Peter explaining why he got involved in this project in the first place.
Well, you know, one of the big obsessions of my life is sport. And I love when sport and the arts meet. So some of my favourite things, I'm going to be talking later on about Billy Crystal.
Yeah.
Some of my favourite things are related to sport. So let me tell you a bit about the sport thing. I was absolutely soccer crazy growing up. My dad was a huge soccer fan. We weren't a Gaelic household at all. In those days, you were either soccer or Gaelic. We were soccer. So I lived for the weekend, the First Division, Man United. My dad took me up to Drumcondra Road when Liam Whelan's remains came in.
Okay.
And I held my dad's hand, and I was a Manchester United supporter for life.
And still
in,
are.
In that moment. Yeah. And still am. Yeah. And my dad loved the football.
Happy to see Ronaldo back?
Completely, 100%. It's amazing. Yeah. But when I was a kid, I was a very good soccer player. And I played for Sheriff United. I captained Sheriff United under 12. And then I was poached by a team from Ringsend called Bolton Athletic. So I went to Bolton Athletic and I established myself there as a very decent player. And Billy Bean paid a visit to our house where I lived.
He was the Manchester United scout, wasn't he?
He was the Manchester United scout. So he told my dad I had real potential. Keep an eye on me and all of that kind of stuff. And we did a trial. There was a trial held in the Phoenix Park where they got together 22 young fellas, myself included, and we played a match. And I didn't make it as a footballer. I wasn't that good. I was good, but not great. And I fell in love with the theatre at about the time that I could have probably dedicated myself to football. I discovered the theatre again through my father. My father introduced me to plays. And the reason my father introduced me to plays was we had a major tragedy in the family. My young brother died, Frankie. It's in everything that we write. It's in our DNA, Jim, myself. We tell stories about it all the time. But when Frankie died, my father took it really, really badly. I think he kind of blamed himself on Frankie's death in some weird way. And he took to the bed and he literally fell apart emotionally. And my mother took over the running of the house. And my mother was utterly and completely amazing in that period of our family's life. She held the ship together. She was utterly fantastic. But after about a year, my dad got out of the bed and came down and made an announcement to the family that he was going to become an actor. That he had always wanted to be an actor.
What age was he when he did that?
42, 43.
Right, so midlife transition.
Midlife transition. He worked at the train station in Amiens Street in the booking office, but now he was going to dedicate himself to fulfilling his lifelong ambition. That life is too short.
Yeah.
Frankie had died. And literally a year after Frankie's death, we met in the Oriel Hall, just off Savile Place. And we sat down and we read the plays of Sean O'Casey, one after the other. And my father gave out the roles, gave out the parts. And suddenly I was reading these plays that could have been set in our kitchen. I didn't know these plays were 1920s. I didn't know who Sean O'Casey was. I didn't know his connection with the Oriel Hall, which was profound. I didn't know his connection with Savile Place and East Wall and the North Circular Road and the Five Lamps. But Sean O'Casey was bound up in all of these things, which I was to discover then in my journey through the theatre with my father.
And in a sense, you didn't know theatre would have been like this. And then so far you were engaged and immersed in this theatre, which you didn't understand. Yeah. And you said this was fantastic.
Look, for example, I was cast as Tommy Owens in The Shadow of a Gunman. Mm-hmm. He's a little sort of little fella from the two pair back, a big mouth. Is there one or two K's in shocking Mr. Gallagher? He's that fella when they're reading the letter in the second act, in the first act. And so I kind of fell in love with these plays and I was just on a journey. It was like a light bulb going on in my head. I just thought, this is the most incredible way to tell a story. People sitting down representing different characters in a situation and there's a drama taking place and you work it out. Mm. And in so many aspects of the O'Casey plays were like our lives. They were like an aspect of our lives. The central character in The Shadow of a Gunman is this guy who sells stuff out of a suitcase, Shields, Seamus Shields. Sure, that was me dad. Me dad spent his life doing knickknacks, doing odd jobs.
Now, sorry, did your dad become then an actor?
Yeah.
Okay.
He started a drama society, the St. Lawrence O'Toole's musical.
So he followed through?
He followed through. Cast himself as Seamus Shields. And off we went on this journey, travelling around all the amateur drama festivals, winning loads of prizes, coming back, performing in the Oriel Hall, doing review shows. Then my dad loved a bit of review, comedy and drama mixed together. Then we did Juno and the Paycock, where I played Joxer to my father's Captain Boyle.
Oh, great.
Now, it's weird for a father and son to play those two characters.
Wow, what a lovely way for a father and son to...
Incredible. And I mean, the fun and crack we had, the two of us, especially when they're eating the sausage in the first act.
Did your relationship change totally then from your father being some of his life up to 42 years of age like this, and then that? Did your relationship with him totally change, possibly for the better?
It changed in that it kind of almost became like a professional thing. I kind of realised that... you know, he wasn't just my dad. Like, emotionally, he never became that available again after Frankie's death. He never really healed from that.
Yeah.
That was the kind of the tragedy that it was impossible to recover from. And in many ways, he kind of he kind of got lost and he found the theatre and I found the theatre with him.
So in that whole, in that lovely monologue, Peter, you sum up your relationship, professional and personal, with your father, your love of theatre, your love of God, Beckett and all of that. And for full disclosure, here we come and you're directing me in Aikino. And but this was the crossover between sport and theatre for you. And this really weird, extraordinary, funny, mad play.
Yeah, I mean, I was the chairman of Andrews Lane Theatre just around the corner here at the time. Pat Moylan, my great friend, my best friend, was owning and running the theatre and I was trying to help her do that. So we were always talking about ideas together and she knew Arthur Matthews quite well. She knew Arthur's sister. And she said, Arthur has a couple of scenes written. She said, would you have a look at them? It's about football. I know nothing about football. So I went home and read these scenes and I laughed out loud. It's not often you laugh out loud reading a script.
So you laughed at it on paper, this Aikino?
I literally laughed. It wasn't even Aikino at that stage. It was just a series of little sketches.
Yeah.
They weren't even scenes.
So and Aikino, for those who don't know, is the story of Saipan, Mick McCarthy and Roy Keane, but set in Roman times and we're all wearing togas.
Yeah. I mean, it's just a genius idea. I mean, it's Monty Python.
Yeah.
I mean, its origins, its genesis is really it's a Monty Python-esque play.
Yeah.
And I look, Monty Python at their best are complete genius.
Yeah.
I mean, they're fantastic.
Yeah.
And this at its best had a whole resonance of Monty Python about it.
Yes.
As you say, you know, we're rowing to the island of Saipan. Yeah. We can't get there in time because they don't provide us with the proper hours. Yeah. I mean, it was just like a metaphor for everything that was wrong with Irish football.
And this was an extraordinary play, though, because you directed it and we had fun doing it. And we had even more fun, I suppose, when it started, because much to our, I suppose, we didn't know, but it absolutely blew up. And I remember, for example, my memories of the play were the opening night. And the opening night were, like, there were lines in the first few pages where I'm going, I don't know, nobody knows how the audience is going to react to this. So, for example, I peeked out through the curtain. I was playing Keno. I peeked out through the curtain and I saw the first four rows of the audience were all wearing Irish shirts. I was going, I'd never seen a theatre audience like that before. And then I came out and my first line as Roy Keane was, hello.
That's right.
And of course, on paper, it's just hello.
Yeah.
After I said hello, there was basically a standing ovation. People went nuts. And for the next 5 minutes, all you could hear was, Keno, Keno. And then you knew it was tribal. It was me against Mick McCarthy.
Well,
and we had all this fun ordinary people who had never been to the theatre before came to the theatre and watched plays.
And the other thing, I mean, there are several things about Aikino that were kind of unique. Women buy 80 to 90% of the theatre tickets. But for this show, men were buying the theatre tickets. They were bringing their girlfriends and wives.
And men who usually didn't go to the theatre.
And men who wanted to be at this show.
Yes.
Wherever it was. Because it had to do with Keane and that event and Saipan.
Yes.
The issue at the core of Aikino was incredibly serious. It only deserved to be made fun of, as Oscar Wilde would have said.
Yes.
It was so important, it needed to be laughed at.
It was so important.
But I spent weeks on RTE radio, particularly the Marion Finucane show. They were ringing me every two or three days to go on and defend Mick McCarthy against Roy Keane over what happened in Saipan. People were on the radio wanting to start a civil war in Ireland. It literally was as deep an issue as the Civil War, as the treaty debates had been in 1921, Saipan and what had happened was as relevant to the Irish, particularly male population, at that moment. So we had an incredibly brilliant, powerful issue at the core of something and the best fun you could ever have about an issue so serious.
And in a sense, it was an issue so stupid that became so serious. In other words, football. But the reason it became serious is because anything can become a polarizing point, Peter. And one of the things about Aikino was, in my opinion, what it polarized or brought people's attention to was the idea of who are we and how we do things. And Aikino was really two sides. It'll be grand or we do it right. And one person was on the side of, at least on the surface, we're going to do this right. And the other fellow was on the side of, look, it'll be fine. It'll be fine. Or in the FAI and the scribes saying it'll be fine. And there was all that sort of stuff. That's one.
But there was one really, really important issue at the core of it in terms of the positions that represented by Roy Keane and Mick McCarthy. Mick McCarthy speaks with a Barnsley accent. He's as Irish as you or me. That was the question. Roy Keane assumed, because Mick had that English vibe about him with the accent and
so he questions
that,
his nationhood.
Roy was more of an Irishman than Mick. He's not more of an Irishman than Mick. Mick McCarthy is an absolute true Irishman, a warrior for us. He was a warrior as a player. He was a warrior as a manager. And how dare anybody decry the fact that he's less Irish because he speaks with an English accent? I thought that was really important. And it was really important that we deal and say something about that. And the play did say things about that.
It did, but it also said things on other stuff as well, which is hugely important in Irish society. Things like gombeanism and the waste and cheating and lying, and lying about the waste. So, for example, this was seen through the FAI and their slovenliness, and then their scribes then in their sycophancy and their ability to take to take sort of bribes almost as for their to shut up about it all, you know. So it raised very big issues about in a very silly, funny way, and it was just great fun. Having said that, Peter, just now that we're on the Aikino thing, obviously I was playing Roy Keane, right? And sometimes when you play somebody like that, you fall in love with them. And I had been performing them on the radio and have been since until now for years and years. And in a way, you fall in love with them. And it takes, you need to grow older to try and step back from them. So I was on Roy Keane's side back in 2004. But since time has passed, I must say, I've not changed, but just reviewed my situation. And I much more see, Mick's conundrum and Mick's dichotomy.
I would have been more on McCarthy's side.
At the time?
Yeah.
And are you still?
At the time that we did Aikino. Yeah, a part of me still feels that, you know, he was in a terrible position.
Yeah.
And that Roy didn't behave as he should have behaved.
Yeah.
That's what I think. I thought that at the time, and I haven't changed my opinion on that.
Yeah.
And I have spent my life standing up to bullies. I hate bullies, and I hate people who bully people.
Well, that's very
And whenever I smell it and whenever I see it, I'm in there.
Yeah.
Because I don't like bullies. And I felt that Roy was a bully in that moment, because he had so much going for him in terms of what he represented and who he was, that he needed to be more measured.
Yeah.
And, you know, to me, he tapped into the emotion of it and went with the emotional thing of it when he needed to be more considered.
Yeah. Okay, fantastic. We leave it there. Actually, I join you on the bullies thing, actually. As you grow older, I suppose you'd find out a bit more about yourself and what you really are. And you kind of lay, at times you have to lay your own cards on the table to yourself about what you are. And one of the things that I've decided for a long time that I hate most in life is people pushing other people around who have the ability to. It's, I guess that's called bullying, but it really, really, I don't know. There's something in me which is a little social justice warrior, and you can't stop it from coming out in yourself. I remember feeling it when I was 12 or 13, and then maybe it passed and I went through other stages of my life, and then it came back, and every so often it comes back until I realized that's part of me. I just fucking hate bullies and I hate bullying, and I hate people. I hate people taking advantage of other people, especially when they cover it up and pretend they're not. In other words, it's almost more admirable to be a bully in the open and go, I'm a bully, than a bully who covers up and bullies people pretending they're not a bully. That's more disgusting to me. But anyway, we move on. We did this play together. And of course, you'd come off the back of, you know, your whole life loving theatre and being a theatre producer and or a director and being a film director and being a playwright. And, you know, Project Arts Centre in the 70s with your brother and everything, a very vibrant time, and Gabriel Byrne and all these people knocking around and some fun, and a very vibrant, even in the world, the 70s was a wonderful time for the cinema and theatre, and very creative, even in the doldrums that was Ireland in the 70s. But what I'd love to come to is jump ahead and go backwards in the story. And just this story, the story of you driving around America with Sean Penn. How that happens, why it happens, what happened during that drive? So why did it happen? What were you doing?
I wasn't expecting that question, but it's a good question. And it's obviously something I will never forget. I had always wanted to do something on Brendan Behan. Always. I mean, the Behans grew up a couple of hundred yards from where we were. So I naturally felt an affinity to them. And I had done an adaptation of Brian Behan's book, Mother of All the Behans, in the late 80s with Rosalie Ninhan. Became a big hit. It was probably my biggest success in my career, certainly up until that point. And we had a tremendous time with that. And out of doing Mother of All the Behans, I got more and more involved in the world of Brendan. Went back to Borstal Boy. And Borstal Boy had a big impact on me. It was one of the first shows I ever saw. Certainly the first show I ever saw in the Abbey Theatre in 1967. Neil Tobin played Behan, and a guy called Frank Grimes played the young Behan. And it absolutely was revolutionary for a whole new generation of theatre goers. The idea of a young Republican going to England like that at 15, you know, wanting to sort of unify Ireland by blowing up Liverpool. I mean, how crazy and insane was all that? And yet, when you explore this individual, he was utterly fascinating, contradictory, lovable, despicable. He had horrible characteristics about him. He had wonderful characteristics about him. He was just an incredible mix of a man. And I could be here all night talking about Brendan. I love Brendan. So Jim had done My Left Foot, which in a kind of a way was my project, because I had done a stage version of the Christy Brown story with Jim directing. It didn't really work.
Yeah,
we lost money on it. It didn't succeed. And Jim said, there's a movie in it. So I said, you better run with that one. You better go off.
So not Noel Pearson saw that. It was Jim that saw the idea that it could be a cinema release.
Now, Pearson was close to Christy Brown. Yeah. So there was two of them in it. So Jim went off and did My Left Foot and Fair Play, and the rest is history. But when that became very successful, he said to me, you need to do the Behan film. So we looked around for, you know, somebody to play it. And I mean, obviously, people would always say to you, well, what about Neil Tobin? And, you know, you think, well, he's not a star. You wouldn't put a budget together in America, certainly, on Neil Tobin at that time. And there was no other Irish actor that was a natural. Gabriel wasn't a natural Behan. You wouldn't have felt, you know. And there was no other Irish actor sort of about the breakthrough right around that time. So we were looking to the States. And somebody suggested Sean Penn because he looked...
Yes,
so
he does.
Behan.
He did.
Yeah.
He does. He has a look of him.
Yeah.
It's especially the profile and the nose and the shape of the head. Yeah. It's kind of a little longer.
Yeah.
And if Sean Penn put on just a little bit of weight around the face, he'd be the spit of him.
Yeah.
The nose.
Well, Jim said, come on to LA and we'll meet up with him. We'll meet him. So I went to Los Angeles and I met Sean. And from the get-go, from that immediate thing, we got on.
So good start.
There was an absolute bond between us very quickly. So much about him I found really interesting. Like, he's called Sean after Sean O'Casey. His mother is Ryan from Tipperary. He loves Ireland. He loves the whole Irish thing. He loves, you know, the badness of Behan. You know, the more bad he is, the better Sean likes him. Some of the old footage of Brendan, you know, where Brian, fuck you, and double fuck you. She goes, I never heard that before. Play that again.
So he's loving him.
He'd want to be listening back to the stuff and those interviews that he did on US television that were legendary.
I saw some of those.
They're legendary.
They are.
Like, I mean, some of the stuff he came out with, Sean was just loving this guy. Yeah. Absolutely loving this guy. And the first thing he decided was that he was going to have his teeth ground down, the two front ones, because Brendan lost them in a fight. So in a lot of photographs of Brendan at that period, he has no front teeth.
Yeah.
And Sean thought it would be great, because he loved the idea of going to extremes, Sean Penn, to have his teeth ground down. And I was fighting with him from day one, saying, you can't do that to your teeth. I'm not going to allow you to grind your teeth down. And he was saying, no, we leave the stubs. It'll be okay, Peter. And it was all that, you know. And so I hung out.
So hold on. This fella now is... Now, he's grinding down his teeth. So he's saying, I'm in.
Yeah.
I'm playing Behan.
Oh, no, he wanted in right from the get-go. From the time I showed him the footage of Behan in America, on those TV shows, he was like, I want to play this guy. I want to be this guy. I want to be this man. And he knew that I knew a lot. And obviously, I'm Irish and I'm Dublin and all of that. And sort of my background in the theatre and all that would have been very similar to his own. His mum's an actress. His dad's a TV director. He comes from a kind of an entertainment family, but he's a radical, he's rebellious, he'd be left wing, you know, he'd be all of that. He'd be on that Warren Beatty, Jack Nicholson,
yeah,
sort of Hollywood kind of bad boys, you know, boys wanting to change the world, you know.
Kennedy Democrat.
Exactly, all of that, motivated and all of that stuff. And I remember you asked me how I ended up driving. What I said to him, you know, we just need to, I said, we need to get a few days together where I just take you through what I think the journey of Brendan's life is. Yeah, where there's no interruptions, where there's nobody else. He said, yeah, let's drive across America together. I said, that's a fantastic idea. He said, yeah, that's a great idea. He said, I only ever did it once before. He said, but I'd love to do it again. So we were trying to make arrangements to do it. And he was shooting a film called Dead Man Walking, which is about a guy getting a lethal injection to kill him. He's been found guilty of a crime. And he said to me, he said, I'm finishing shooting that on, let's say it was the 18th of March. He said, if I don't get away on the 19th of March, we won't get this done. You come to New York, come to the rap party, and the next day we'll set off for LA. So I met him in New York. He had a car called a Buick Grand National.
Okay, yeah.
A big motherfucker of a car. Enormous thing. And the two of us jumped in the car and we headed off. And the only thing we had in the car, I mean, at that time, mobile phones were enormous things.
Yeah.
Like, you couldn't even get proper reception in a car with the phone. So you were kind of left alone. And you would have to stop in certain places to make a phone call. And then you could make a call. But it was kind of uninterrupted. Now, his head, after that movie that he had just made, was completely melted.
Mm.
There was no talking in the car.
Mm. He was catatonic.
For the first 2 days, there was no conversation. Now, the thing about me is, because I don't drink anymore or do drugs, I'm okay with that.
Yeah.
I'm comfortable in my own skin.
Yeah.
I don't need to be rabbiting on, and I don't need to be, you know, having conversations that I don't need to be having. And I'm not a star-struck person. I don't get struck by people who are famous. I can see through that very quickly.
So you were grand the first couple
of days. I'm not interested. Yeah. So we just, that first 2 days, we listened to Dolores O'Riordan singing.
Hmm.
And other people, I brought tapes with me of people. The Dubliners, Luke Kelly.
Hmm.
So we were just driving and not talking. And I said to Sean, I'm totally okay with this. I said, you just go asleep there if you want, and you do what you want. I said, but I'm really enjoying this driving through upstate New York.
And if you ever want to talk about Brendan Behan, let me know.
Yeah.
4 days to go, Sean, if you ever feel like. His name is Brendan, the guy you're thinking of playing, yeah. So anyway, you're asleep. Okay, yeah, okay, go on.
But that was it. Like, it was it. And then we booked into hotels at night time and...
But you didn't sleep in the same bed like you and Jimmy.
No, we didn't sleep in the same bed. But he was always looking for a thrill, you know.
Yeah.
So wherever the gentleman's club was, that's where he wanted to go. And
then,
you know, once he appeared in a place like that, everybody came around him. It's like royalty, you know.
Yeah. Did he like the attention?
Loved it. Yeah. Everybody wanted to buy him a drink. And he had great stories about people putting stuff in his drink over the years.
Mm.
Nearly killed him a couple of times. Mm. Yeah, people would love to do it in Sean Penn. There's people who hate him.
Yeah, because he was quite a polarising character himself. His relationship with Madonna and everything.
Totally polarising, yeah.
Sean Penn is wound up to the max in his brain. He's forgotten about Dead Man Walking.
Brendan
Behan is in his mind.
He's listening to me telling stories.
Are you going to direct this, Peter?
Oh, yeah. And I'm going to...
And co-write it.
And co-write it, yeah. And one of the big things for Sean, because Sean just loves living on the edge, the fact that I'm a sober guy, the fact that I gave up the drink a couple of years previous to this, I gave up in 89 and this was like 92, 93. So I was 3 years off the drink and the drugs, and he felt really safe with me. He knew that I wouldn't bring him into danger, that I would look after him. So he could kind of relax a good bit and kind of be himself. So on that journey across America, you know, I could feel this growing bond between the two of us on that basis of, I was kind of like a little bit of a father figure to him. Yeah. I was kind of looking after him in the same way that my father looked after me creatively when I was 15 and Frankie was dead. And my father had introduced me to all of this world of Sean O'Casey. I was introducing him to the world of Brendan Behan and the whole thing of Dublin in the 1950s. And we just got on fantastically well. Never had a row. And there's things about Sean, like, after we finished, that journey finished after a phone call he made to Robin Roy Penn on the road. We stopped. He had to ring her. He had to ring Robin Roy Penn. He got back into the car. He said to me, drive me to the airport in Colorado. What's the big city in Colorado?
Boulder?
No.
Denver?
Denver. Drive me to Denver airport. I have to get home. I said, why have you got home? He said, it's Robin. Robin just gone mad about the kids and I'm afraid she's going to jump state with them. And I'll never see them again. You got to get me to an airport. So I drove Sean to Denver and I drove on to Las Vegas after I dropped him and spent 2 weeks in Las Vegas in the Buick Grand National, which he left with me, right? He headed off. And then he came to Dublin and he said, I have to make it up to you for jumping ship on the trip. So I said, fine. He said, come on, we go to Amsterdam. I said, now look, Sean, you got to know something about me. I'm not a wealthy guy. I subsist on a fair. He said, no, this is on me. This is on me. I said, look, I'll pay you back when we make the movie. He said, yeah, pay me back when we make the movie. But that was typical Sean. He paid for the trip to Amsterdam. Plane, hotels, everything. Never put my hand in my pocket. And just generally, never ever mentioned it again. Ever. Mm-hmm. Just the generosity of him was just like, that was him, you know, that was him. And like, you'd be sitting in a bar with me coke or whatever I was having, and John with a few drinks on him, you know, and he'd say, you're like a blood brother to me. Come here. And he grabbed me hand and he broke a bottle on the table and he cut my hand and he cut his hand and he made us rub blood together.
Intense.
I'm thinking, this is like Stand By Me or something. Yeah, it's like 15-year-olds who want to be blood brothers.
Yeah.
But he loves all that stuff. Yeah. He loves all that. That's really important to him.
Part of being, look, I'm sorry to puncture your balloon a bit, but part of being a performer and an artist is not growing up and just fucking staying young. You know, growing up and growing older for daddies who pay mortgages and bills and accountants and stuff like that. Artists stay young so that you can see life through a child's eyes and cut your hands and go, we're blood brothers, bitch. So come on, the movie.
So the movie, you know, I spent quite a bit of time in Hollywood auditioning. I mean, one of the great joys of doing a project with Sean Penn is every actress in the world wants to be in the movie playing his wife, which is Beatrice. And Beatrice I knew very well because obviously she outlived Brendan by a long way. And I got to know Beatrice in her later years very well. And I used to take her out to the theatre. She loved the theatre. And of course, her sister was an actress, Celia. Celia Salkeld was a very, very well-known actress in Dublin in the 50s, right into the 60s. And so everybody wanted to play Beatrice.
Yes.
All the actresses.
And were you at auditioning level now?
Yeah.
Okay, so you're seeing top actresses for the role.
I saw Renée Zellweger when she was unknown.
Wow.
She was a total unknown.
For Behan's wife.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
And she was she used to drive around in a VW van.
Yeah.
That's how she came. She came to the audition in a VW van.
Excellent.
And she was from a part of Texas that I know, near Austin. And we got on great.
Yeah.
I got on great with Renée. Yeah. And I got on great with Embette Davids, the girl who was in with Liam Neeson in Schindler's List.
Oh, okay.
Schindler's List. She was fantastic. South African actress. Mm. Brilliant. Mm. Brilliant. But like mad stories, the things the actresses would do to try and get your attention.
As in to get you in the room or in general.
Say they'd audition for you, right? And then on the way out, you'd notice they dropped something.
Yeah.
And I'd go to tell them they had dropped something and the casting agent would say, no. It's a note for you to tell you something. So you'd pick up the note and the note would say something like, I prayed to God today to put me in the right place to be this lovely woman, Beatrice. I hope you take me on.
Right.
Like literally asking to be cast.
Yeah.
Like these are I can't name names.
No, don't. Know.
But we're talking about like some of the most famous people in Hollywood.
Pulling stunts like that.
Are doing that stuff.
Yeah.
And then...
They killed their granny for a part.
I know.
So you're at auditioning stage and then?
And then came back to Ireland and did more rewrites, the whole thing, you know, got the budget together.
Budget?
Yeah.
Got budget?
Got a budget
together.
How much? At the time, At the time, I think we were talking about $8 million.
Yeah, okay. So pretty small to medium.
Small to medium. Mm. And we were in pre-production. I had a designer, had, you know, all of those other smaller parts cast.
And you had cast all the smaller parts. Sean is in.
On the Friday before the Monday, he was to come to Ireland. He rang me and said he couldn't come.
And why was that?
Again, problems with...
personal problems.
Yeah, with the wife. Yeah.
Okay.
He said, if I go to Ireland, I'll lose my family.
And did that put the kibosh on the project?
Yeah. Killed it stone dead.
Fuck.
Yeah.
What was the name of it?
The Bells of Hell. And the problem is that people who are not involved in this business, you know, outsiders, would always say things to you like, but you could have got somebody else.
Hmm.
And here's the thing. In Hollywood, nobody does the project that Sean Penn just turned down. No, nobody fills in for Sean Penn, you understand?
Mm-hmm.
Good actors, actors at the top range level, they don't fill in, they don't take over when somebody like Sean Penn drops out. That's the Sean Penn dropout project?
Yes.
No, I wouldn't be doing that.
Yes.
It doesn't happen that way.
No.
You don't get people in that way. It just doesn't happen.
Mm.
And particularly with something like that, which is an Irish project of an Irish character.
Mm.
It's not even like they're playing American.
Mm.
It's a big deal of a thing to do, to take on an iconic Irish figure like that. And you're just not going to get anybody.
Did he ever contact you again about
it? Ah, yeah. Like, I've seen him many, many times since then. And he always contacts me if he's in Dublin.
Yeah, and he was did a thing with Mel Gibson, didn't he?
Yeah, he did, yeah. He did. I saw him. He had his, I think it was his 50th birthday, was it, he had when he was here. I was at it. I was there. Yeah. And, you know, if I contacted him, when I, if I'm in the States, if I happen to know he's somewhere, it's only ever friendly and warm and, you know. Now, he has bad sides to him.
Yes.
You know, he dropped me in the shit. He killed my project. I mean, I always remember M. Bette David saying to me, Peter, don't let Sean Penn kill your project. Please don't let Sean Penn kill your project.
Mm.
Because they know sometimes.
Mm.
And I remember... who was with Susan Sarandon? Who's the actor?
Tim Robbins.
Tim Robbins. I had a coffee with Tim Robbins in New York one day with Jim, the two of us. And he was saying, Sean has to be ready, he said. If Sean's not ready, you won't do it. Mm. Now, when I say ready in his head, it's not to do other stuff. It's to do with, am I ready to take on this thing? Because he puts himself right to the limit for you. And he ain't going to put himself right to the limit unless his head is in a place that tells him, I'm going to put myself out there.
I kind of figured that, Peter, when you said he ground his teeth down to a stump. So, absolutely. But you, beautiful story. Beautiful
That's
story. And I love that story.
What's happening? I bet you were expecting one of the other Go Loud podcast hosts, but no.
Instead, you get me, Tidy Flower.
And me, CLB. And we're interrupting your podcast to tell you all about the great content on Disney Plus this Christmas.
There's the Emmy Award winning The Bear, which follows a struggling restaurant and the staff trying their best to make it better. You think there's carnage in your gaff over a game of 30 seconds? You should see what happens with these fellas just trying to make a sandwich.
Mate, that gives me mad anxiety watching them running around the kitchen, but you can't look away because you need to know what's going to happen next.
There's also one of the year's biggest box office hits, Deadpool and Wolverine with Ryan Reynolds and Hugh Jackman. It's a superhero film and a comedy all in one.
And don't forget the Christmas classics like Home Alone and Die Hard.
Is Die Hard a Christmas film? He's fighting terrorists, isn't it?
Yeah, but at Christmas.
Look, I'm happy with any excuse to watch Bruce Willis battering people. And there's a show that everyone's talking about, Rivals, which is some buzz.
Well, then go ahead and sign up to Disney Plus at $9.99 per month.
Christmas is better with Disney Plus. All the days and more streaming this Christmas.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger for thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
High Five Casino lets you play your favorite slot and live table games, like blackjack, with the chance to redeem for real cash prizes. High Five Casino has a giant selection of over 1,200 games, including hundreds of exclusive games only found on High Five Casino. It's always free to play, and free coins are given out every 4 hours.
Ready to have your own high-five moment? Visit highfivecasino.com. That's high, the number five, casino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. Must be 21 years or older. Terms and conditions apply.
And one of the things you alluded to there, of course, was at the time you weren't drinking or taking drugs.
Yeah.
And I had a lovely fella on the podcast, Ty Kickey. He's a comedian. He's a Cork comedian. And I had him on the Sunday Roast, my radio show, a couple of years ago, which you used to appear on as well. Mm. And he told me a very interesting story about being an alcoholic. And of course, it was the idea that, you know, a lot of stories of alcoholism are drowned in depression and mordancy and morbidity and kind of the dark days. But of course, he told me fantastic stories of his life as an alcoholic. He said it was some of the best crack I ever had. Yeah. And of course, you had a kind of a helter-skelter life as a complete alcoholic as well. And you described that you were, I think you described at one stage that you were outside when you were an alcoholic, you were okay, and it's only when maybe you came home that you were more angry.
Yeah, I was completely fine in the social setting.
And you were functional as well, able to hold down.
Totally functional, yeah. I mean, I did make some mistakes professionally in my career when I was drinking, but for me it was all the damage I did within the family.
Yeah.
Within the home, to Sheila, to the kids.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You were a functional, functional alcoholic, and you left it, you know, you did a bit of damage family-wise and everything. But listen, not to be facetious or facile about the thing, you added, you threw the frying pan into the fire as well by adding cocaine into the mix.
Yeah.
And of course, this is perfect for an Irishman, of course, because cocaine has the effect of being able to sober you up so that you can drink more.
This is true. This is true.
And so you're there. Oh, I'm a bit pissed. I get a bit of cocaine and then I'm sober as a judge. I can do more drink.
I got my cocaine habit in LA, actually doing a play. It wasn't a film.
Was it in the 80s?
It was in the 80s, yeah. It was in the mid 80s. I was working with Colin Meaney.
Oh, great.
The great Colin Meaney and his then wife, Barbara, who's since passed away. We were doing a piece on the hunger strikes, which I'd written in a theatre in LA. But he was playing the lead and she was playing his girlfriend. And I was in a hotel on 7th Avenue in LA, mainly Mexican, Guatemalan, El Salvadorian workers, all those kind of guys. And the lead guy of all of this troop of immigrants was a Cuban guy who was known as Cuban Mike. And he was the local cocaine dealer. And I drank in the local pub. It was called Monty's of all things, like Monto Monty's. And I drank in this pub. And I was a pretty good pool player. I always have been a good snooker and pool player. And could really hold my own with these guys. You had real clout when you could hold your own at pool with all of these guys. And Cuban Mike was very impressed that I could beat some of the top guys in the bar at the pool. I became his friend very quickly, and he loved horse racing. And he used to go to Santa Anita all the time. And I always remember it was the time of the Cheltenham Gold Cup, and I told him that a horse called Don Run...
1985 or 6.
Don Run would win the Gold Cup.
The mayor's going to get up.
And he got a bet on it. And he won some money. And he gave me a horse in return, which also won. And when that horse won, I bought him a bottle of brandy in the local off-license and put it behind the bar for him, which you could do in LA. And he said, Pete, in all my years, nobody's ever bought me a bottle of brandy before. You're my brother. You're my brother. And I had free coke for life.
Right.
I had a supply of coke that was so outrageous. Never had to put my hand in my pocket.
Scarface levels.
Oh, for God's sake. It was just like within 3 or 4 weeks, I was in big trouble.
You were a Dublin Al Pacino. Say hello to my little friend. Now, let me introduce you to my brother, Cuban fucking Mike. Now... Shut the fuck up, Mike. Let me take another bit of coke. Colin Meaney, shut the fuck up. Get your neck out of the brandy. Okay.
They made me the general of the bar.
Yeah.
On Paddy's Day, 17th of March.
The general?
I was the general. I was in charge of the bar.
Okay.
And the only thing I had to do was I had to sing a song in Irish.
Yes.
They wanted to hear my native language.
Yes.
They put me up on the counter and they made me sing. So I'm looking down at a sea of all Guatemalans, Cubans, El Salvadorians.
And what are you singing?
Bargeen, Isle of Me, Dimmy, Gagoli. And all the tears running down their faces. At this Irishman singing in his native tongue. And Cuban Mike. Cuban Mike says, so Pete, what's the fucking problem over there in your country? I said, Mike, the problem is the British came over and they took our country over. What do you mean they came over? In what way? How did they come over? I said, in boats. He said, in fucking boats. He said, I thought your country was stuck onto them. I thought they came across your border.
Yeah.
Like the border we got down south. I said, no, 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 we don't have a border with
Britain.
Oh, for fuck's sake. That's as much as they knew about Ireland, you know?
Yep.
And so Cuban Mike was my local coke dealer. Yes. And I came home to Ireland with a very nice habit of cocaine.
And was Ireland doing it at the time?
Very small amount.
Yeah, so.
This would have been,
yeah.
You know, the level I was at was like a level nobody else was at.
Mm.
And I knew I had to do something about it. I knew. I stopped.
Introduced large amounts of, so you started doing then, you started running tons of cocaine into Ireland then.
Do you know what I did, which is actually true?
What?
As a way of trying to deflect myself from my problems.
Yeah.
I knew I had a problem with the coke. Yeah. And I definitely knew I had a problem with alcohol. And I definitely knew I had a problem with cigarette smoking. Because mm-hmm. I smoked like a fucking chimney. Yeah. So I looked at the three of them and I thought, I might get away with giving up the cigarettes here.
Yeah.
And that's what I did. I gave up smoking cigarettes.
Right.
When I got back to Dublin.
Okay.
And I said to Sheila after a week at home, have you not noticed anything? She said, what? I said, I'm not smoking.
Mm.
Oh, she said, Jesus, I'd forgotten, because of course she didn't smoke.
Mm. But you've had loads of energy. And you can drink like a horse for some reason.
Oh, God.
Anyway.
I gave up the cigarette. 12th of May, 1985.
And you did. And you also gave up cocaine and you gave up alcohol as well. And you
There's a payoff to the cigarette story.
Yes.
I was kind of building it up for you.
Oh, okay.
Okay. So on the 12th of May, 1985, I stopped smoking cigarettes.
Mm-hmm.
But I knew that I really needed to stop drinking.
Mm.
It took me another 3 years to get around to the drink.
Okay.
But I got a lot of brownie points out of giving up the cigarettes.
Mm.
And being the determined kind of guy that I am and very single-minded, I stuck with not smoking. And I stuck with it. And I banged my head off the wall and trying to write plays as I had done with my cup of coffee and my cigarettes. And there was now no fucking cigarettes. Like, I became a coffee addict and a fucking tea addict and anything to put into something in my mouth. But I stuck with it. And 30 years later, I'm doing a gig to launch a book of mine. And my wife says to me after, there's something wrong with your throat. I said, what do you mean? She said, you sound different than you normally do. She said, it's just a very definite sound, Peter. She said, I really think you should have it checked out. I said, So I let it go, but it kind of was an idea in my head that wouldn't go away. So 4 or 5 weeks later, I went out to see my doc. I said, Sheila says there's something with my voice. My voice is not the same as it was. So she had a look down. She said, she's right.
Not you.
You need to see a specialist. And a week later, a guy said, you have cancer of the esophagus. You've throat cancer.
Go on.
And he went down through my chart. He looked at all of the things I filled in. He said, you're going to survive it. He said, and there's only one reason that you're going to survive it, that you stopped smoking in 1985.
Right.
He said, that's the reason you're going to survive. He said, I have men sitting across from me all the time, he said, who are still smoking and they won't make it.
Yeah.
But you've a very good chance. In fact, you've an incredibly good chance. It's very small, but it's there and we need to deal with it. So I underwent 30 sessions of radiation, which dealt with my cancer, got rid of my cancer. And here's the irony of life. The specialist who did all that for me contracted cancer of the stomach, a very rare cancer, and was dead in 3 weeks.
Mm.
So it makes you really think on life, how fickle this whole thing is.
Brings you back to the
the guy who cured me,
to
the guy who got me through.
Sam Beckett.
It's the same story.
Flicker.
It's a flicker. It's just like, how did that happen?
Yeah.
How did this man with such a wonderful gift, who helped me, and two friends of mine who were diagnosed at the same time as me, were dead within 3 months. So I feel like a very blessed individual.
Yes.
And I was left with a few stories to tell.
You are, and a fantastic voice as well. You have a great voice. Great Dublin voice. There's so many other things we could talk about, Peter, but your Sean Penn story really took up so much great time that I'm going to have to truncate it slightly, because I ask all my guests for a little checklist. Comedy. You love the history of comedy series and Sky Arts. Billy Crystal at the funeral of Muhammad Ali. What's that?
You got to watch it.
Routine?
Well, he did a show. I didn't know there was a show called 15 Rounds, where he does his career in 15 rounds. He does Muhammad Ali's career, Billy Crystal. So he starts off, ding, my name is Cassius Clay. And he does the whole beginnings of it. And it is absolutely brilliant, beyond brilliant. It is just, what makes it so brilliant is he's a white guy doing a black man, which shouldn't be allowed. But it's brilliant. So you can't deny it. You can't be going at it. Oh, why are they letting a white? Because he also does Howard Cosell here in Zaire. Some people call it Zaire, but they're wrong. It's Zaire.
The rumble in the jungle.
Exactly. But he does Howard Cosell and Muhammad Ali. His Muhammad Ali impression just makes you cry.
Right.
It's so spot on. Well, it's absolutely brilliant. And the show is just, you know, his and I mean, he does some of the moves and all. I mean, the crowd go mental for it. It's one of the great sporting things of all time.
Out of nowhere, the state of Georgia, 1970, gave me a license to come back and fight Jerry Quarry. Ugly Jerry Quarry. I couldn't wait. Only took 3 rounds. Foop! Knocked that sucker out. Then I went into Madison Square Garden against Oscar Bonavina. Ugly, he's awkward, you know, coming at me. Duh, 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 duh. 15 rounds I had to go. 15 rounds. And I used the left hook. Foop! Knock him out. And now Joe Frazier's the champion. I want Joe Frazier.
The winner and still heavyweight champion, Joe Frazier.
I still think I won. Now I guess I gotta start all over again.
Finally, Peter, it's been brilliant talking to you. We wanted to ask you: would you like to be interrogated by Miriam O'Callaghan? Would you like to be eviscerated by Roy Keane, or would you like to be celebrated by Christy Moore?
Well, obviously it's Christy. I had a drama project way back, a community project in the early 80s, and I asked Christy to come in and teach them a couple of songs. And this was the first song he taught them. There is a page in history when the workers first fought back, when the might of exploitation at last began to crack, in farm and field and factory, in workshop, mine and mill, that beacon bright, that flaming light, that light it's shining still. And Connolly was there, Connolly was there, bold, brave, undaunted, James Connolly was there.
Well, good afternoon to you. Joe Duffy would be absolutely delighted with that. The great revolutionary and the socialist, James Connolly, celebrated by Peter Sheridan. Peter Sheridan's there. Yeah, good afternoon to you. Liveline 1850-715-100. If you have any response to Peter Sheridan's song as James Connolly, we'd be delighted to hear it. But say hello to Christy. Christy's on the line. He'd like to talk to you.
Hello, Christy. How are you doing?
How's it going, Peter? I'm absolutely over the moon to be listening to you there today, and the stories of the cocaine and the drinking and the Cubans flying out of roofs and Sean Penn grinding his teeth down on E and blinding everybody and jumping across the desert and Sean Robin Wright Penn jumping state with the children. It's just, you're a compelling storyteller, Peter, and I don't know. You're very easy to write songs about because I write songs about Irish heroes and you make Silken Thomas look like a fucking bore, to be honest with you. So I wrote, Andy Irvine calls it writ, or Donal Lunny calls it wrote. But anyway, I wrote a little ballad about you, and I hope you don't mind. Would you like me to sing it for you, Peter?
Go for it.
That's great. I loved your singing, by the way. Don't give up the day job. So listen here, the Bowron is there in the background. Here we go. Can you hear the old Bowron, Peter? Oh, Peter Sheridan's the man. There's no one quite like him. Well, there is this other feller, vaguely similar, but that's his brother Jim. Peter's written lovely plays, the best I've ever seen. He'll talk the hind legs off a feckin' donkey when it comes to Brendan Bean. So I salute the Dian of the theatre, our Quentin Tarantino, the man who made me laugh my bollocks off when I went to see Ikeno.
Peter?
Yeah, Christie is terrific.
Thank you so much.
That's a very brilliant imitation. I mean, you've absolutely nailed that one. It's brilliant.
Thank you so
much. It's brilliant.
Peter Sheridan, thank you so much.
And that's it. Thanks to Peter Sheridan. Thanks to On Ice, our great sponsor. Get out and about. They're in Dublin, Waterford, Cork, Galway, Limerick, Marina Market in Cork, and Dublin in Dundrum and Swords. Onice.ie for your tickets. See you soon.
What's happening? I bet you were expecting one of the other Gowlail podcast house, but no.
Instead, you get me, COB.
And me, Terry Flower, and we're interrupting your podcast to tell you all about the great content on Disney Plus this Christmas.
That's the Emmy Award-winning The Bear, which follows a struggling restaurant and their staff trying their best to make it better. You think there's carnage in your gaff over a game of 30 seconds? You should see what happens when these fellas try and make a sandwich.
Gives me mad anxiety, bro, watching them rushing around the kitchen all the time, but I can't look away. I need to know what happens next.
There's also one of the biggest blockbuster hits of the year, Deadpool and Wolverine, with Ryan Reynolds and Hugh Jackman. It's a superhero film and a comedy all rolled into one.
And don't forget the Christmas classics like Home Alone and Die Hard.
Is Die Hard a Christmas film? He's fighting terrorists in it.
Yeah, but at Christmas.
I'm happy with any excuse to watch Bruce Willis battering people. And there's a show that everyone's talking about, Rivals, which is some laugh.
Well then go ahead and sign up to Disney Plus for just $9.99 a month.
Christmas is better with Disney Plus. All the days and much more streaming this Christmas.